Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and lucky us, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic and guide. As I like to say, to all things cinematic, he joins us weekly. I don't know where you got these films. They are Gava Guy, Eighth Grade, and Blind Spotting. That's it for me. Hi, David.
Where did I get these films? I got these films from movie theaters, in that sort of place.
What is a Gava Guy? Is that like a lava lamp?
Oh, I am just about to explain Gava Guy, so put on your philosophy hat.
Ah.
Yeah, Gava Guy is the first of three films I'd like to talk about today, and this is a very, very, very independent movie made by a very, very, very independent filmmaker named Rob Tregenza. And I've actually known Rob for quite a number of years, although I haven't seen him now in quite a number of years. He made his debut with a very interesting movie back in 1988 called Talking to Strangers. After that, he made a very different sort of movie called The Ark back in the early 90s. And he's only made two films since then before his new movie, Gava Guy. And Rob has a particular interest. He's always interested in using particular cinematic techniques in meaningful ways that mesh in very intimately with the subject matter of the movie that he's making, the narrative of the story that he's telling. And in this case, Gava Guy is very much using the long take, the shot that goes on for a long time without a cut. We have the first example of this at the very beginning of the film when a man gets off a train, walks away from the train, sort of disappears around a bend in the road, and the camera keeps going and going, and then all of a sudden the man is back, only now he's running! And he runs and he jumps back on the train because he forgot something. So it's sort of an amusing little twist on the long take. There's a surprise in it. But mainly we are now introduced to the rhythm of this movie, the tempo of this movie, which will be very gradual. Gava Guy is a very good example of what's nowadays called slow cinema. There's been a trend of this. A lot of us fancy pants film critics are very interested in this idea of slow cinema. I think actually that it's become much too much of a kind of a catchword nowadays. But movies made by people like the Hungarian filmmaker Bellatar and the Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky and various others who love to use the long take and who only like to cut to a new shot when there's a real reason to. So one of the things that Gava Guy is very much is an exercise in slow cinema, particularly in the long take and the narrative that unfolds very slowly. Also, it was shot gorgeously in Norway on 35mm film, which is nowadays almost something of a rarity because nowadays so many people use digital video and so forth. But Rob Tregenza still very much believes in the tradition of good old-fashioned 35mm cinema, which gives you an image of a quality that is very hard to beat. So what does that title mean after all, Gava Guy? Well, this came from the enormously important analytical philosopher W.V. Quine. And basically, it's a word that means a word in some language that you don't know. It might be an imaginary language. It might be a language that you simply are unfamiliar with that can be interpreted in multiple ways, either because it's standing alone or because the behavior that it seems to be associated with is ambiguous or itself can be interpreted in multiple ways. So that's what Gava Guy means. It's a word that we can never be sure of what the translation of it ought to be. And in this case, we have the story of a man who is traveling in Norway, and he is very much involved with the poetry of a real Norwegian poet named Tarjei Vesaas. And his wife, this our main character, his wife was translating this Norwegian poet's poetry into Chinese, and then she got sick and died. And so now her grieving husband is very much mourning over her death, and he is now traveling around Norway, and he is trying to continue this project. And he hires himself a driver. This is a very important part of the film, because this local driver is really a very ordinary guy who's just willing, because there's enough money in it for him, to drive this poetry translator around from place to place, and the two of them develop a relationship, and the driver is having his own troubles with the woman who he would like to marry. There's kind of a contentious relationship there. So we have here a story of a grieving husband, the story of a man who's having trouble with his own girlfriend, and we have very much this project to translate the poetry, and all of this shot in these luxurious shots that go on and on and have this gradual rhythm. So obviously this is not a film for the great masses of people. Most people will simply not be interested in this. But I must say, I found it absolutely mesmerizing. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, gorgeously shot, very, very finely acted. We hear a good deal of Norwegian poetry on the soundtrack, and this is one place where I felt the film was a little bit miscalculated, because it's hard to take in this poetry when we just sort of hear it recited on the soundtrack in this sort of sententious way. But the movie as a whole is absolutely gorgeous if you're interested in poetry, if you're interested in language, above all, if you're interested in what a movie camera can do going the exact opposite direction of the kind of fast-cutting cut that is so fashionable in today's cinema, then Gavagai is the movie for you. It's a really, really fine film, and one of the best I've seen at least this year, and in fact one of the best I've seen in quite a few years. So now turning to a totally different direction, Eighth Grade. Eighth Grade is a movie written and directed by Bo Burnham, and he is also an actor. He was in The Big Sick, for example, and he's a screenwriter. This is his first movie as director. He wrote and directed Eighth Grade. And this film has been gathering rave reviews from critics all over the place, and I mean pretty much unanimous rave reviews, which means, of course, that I would love to jump on the bandwagon. And although it's a very nice movie, I liked it, I still like it, thinking about it afterwards, I can't say that it's a great movie. I can't say it's a movie that thrilled me or anything like that. I can just say it's a nice little film. In this respect, it's very much like last year's film Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig. That's another movie which got rave reviews from critics who were calling a perfect movie experience. And I looked at it and I thought, it's a nice little movie. The same goes for Eighth Grade. So anyway, what is Eighth Grade about? You guessed it. It is about a girl who is in the eighth grade. Her name is Kayla, and she is marvelously played by Elsie Fisher, a very, very fine young actress who I'm sure we'll be hearing a great deal more from in the future. And she is in the eighth grade, and she lives with her father, whose name is Mark, and he's played by Josh Hamilton. And it's not quite clear what happened to her mother. Apparently she left. There's a reference to that in the movie. She didn't get sick and die or anything like that. Apparently she walked away. But now Kayla, going into, starting to approach her middle teens, is living with her father. And he's a very, very nice guy who is doing everything he can to be a good father to Kayla. And what she goes through are the trials and travails that probably every single eighth grader in America, if not every single eighth grader everywhere in the cosmos, goes through. She wants to have a boyfriend, but she's sort of nervous and shy around boys. She wants to have regular girlfriends, but she's sort of nervous and shy and can't quite get in with the in crowd as much as she tries. And so she is always sort of looking for the second best thing, and that sometimes does really turn out to be second best. Certainly nowhere near the top of the line experience that she wants to have, etc. So that's one of the things I think that is not so excellent about the movie, is that it is not really very original. It kind of deals with the things that we expect the movie to deal with. That said, it deals with them in nice and sensitive and humorous ways. One thing that is unusual about our main character, Kayla, is that she does videos. She makes videos of advice for her friends, and she posts them on YouTube. And so we see a whole lot of that. In fact, that's the very first thing we see in the movie. And then we return to that over the course of the film, is her doing her little videos. And, be yourself. That's my advice. How do you be yourself? What does it mean to be yourself? Well, it means you sort of have to sort of be yourself, And I found these a little bit too cute and too almost articulate, too calculatedly almost articulate to be fully believable. But again, I rather enjoyed watching them. And certainly a lot of the secondary characters are played by, by very gifted young people who know what they're doing And there's a whole lot of really excellent young acting talent out there, and it's nice to see some of them getting what is their first major exposure in this film. The honors of the day really go to Elsie Fisher, though, as Kayla, and Josh Hamilton as her father. Very, very good performances in a movie which, I have to say one more time, is a nice little film, but not the transcendent experience that many people are making it out to be. Then again, if you are in or close to eighth grade, you very well might find it a transcendent experience for that reason. And hey, I take my hat off to all of those people. I remember when I was in eighth grade, and I probably would have liked this movie more then than I do now. Our last film of the day is kind of the most ambitious, at least in terms of concept, Blindspotting, which is one word. Blindspotting is another movie that's been getting rave reviews. I don't think it quite deserves comparisons with Spike Lee's total all-time masterpiece, Do the Right Thing. It has been compared with that film. But Blindspotting is still a very considerable movie. It is the first feature directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, but the real sort of forces behind it appear to be the stars of it, the writers of it, Rafael Casal and Bobby Diggs. These are guys who are mainly known for hip-hop. Diggs was in Hamilton, in the original production of Hamilton, playing both Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette, very important roles in that show, and he got a Tony Award for that. Although, and he's the main African-American character of Blindspotting, but the project apparently started with the white member of the pair, Rafael Casal, a Hispanic member of the pair. He apparently dreamed up this project to begin with, although both these guys, again, were known for hip-hop before they got into these other areas. And what we have here is the story of, again, both of these guys, both of these main characters are very, very important. David Diggs plays Colin, Rafael Casal plays Miles, and they're both very important, but it is really Colin's story. He is a young man who went to jail, just got out of jail fairly recently, for a felony crime, which we find out what it was around the middle of the movie. And he is now on probation, and he is living in a halfway house, and he has a curfew, and he has to be back every night at a certain time, or else he gets into a lot of trouble and could even end up going back to jail. These guys both live in Oakland, which is rapidly gentrifying. That's a very important part of the movie. And Colin and Miles work together for a moving company. So that puts them in touch with some of this gentrifying stuff that's going on, moving furniture around, cleaning out houses, and so forth and so on. The title, by the way, Blindspotting, refers to that famous psychological phenomenon where you can look at a sort of semi-abstract pattern and either see two faces facing one another or a vase with dark shadows on either side. And that's what the movie refers to. It's about how we rarely see the whole picture. We always seem to be seeing other people and even other situations in partial terms, and we often have trouble seeing all their implications at once. So that's where the title comes from. And it's a very interesting metaphor used in this movie. Now, Blindspotting starts out with an enormous amount of banter between our two characters, our two main characters, our black guy and our white guy. And they are bantering and they are talking in semi-hip-hop language, and sometimes the movie veers over and is in actual rap language. Sometimes it's ordinary speech and sometimes it's actual rap language. In that way, it sort of recalls the show Hamilton, which so many people have seen by now. But there's a whole lot of banter and amazingly fast back and forth and clever stuff and, you know, biting stuff and all that. And at first I thought, oh, this is going to be one of these modern buddy movies, and it's just going to be these two guys having a good time with each other and exchanging digs and insults and clever remarks, and it's going to go on for a couple of hours, and I'll think it's an okay movie. But then it gets much more interesting than that as it goes along, because it turns out that this movie, as funny as some of it is and as sort of fast and clever as it pretty much all is, it is very much about real issues, and it is particularly very much about the violence that is lurking just below the surface and frequently erupts above the surface in a place like Oakland and in sort of very mixed and tense communities all over the United States. So it's very much about that, not just the violence, although that does erupt a couple of times in the movie, and pretty shockingly so, but the tension, the constant simmering tension. So what happens at the very beginning of the movie is that the black guy, Colin, is driving his moving truck, has to hurry to get back to his halfway house before curfew, and he sees a violent incident involving a white cop and a black suspect who is fleeing. Colin doesn't do anything about this. He can't get involved. He can't afford to. But this recurs throughout the movie, what he witnessed and the effect that it has on his life. And eventually there's a confrontation between Colin and this white cop, and it's very, very tense stuff indeed. So Blindspotting turns out to be about very, very serious issues. Blindspotting is the latest of a number of films which are very fortunately and very belatedly raising the profile of African Americans in American cinema. We just recently had Sorry to Bother You, we had the huge super production Black Panther, we had Superfly, we had Get Out last year, which was a very, very big hit. We even had the documentary Whitney, and pretty soon we're going to be seeing Spike Lee's new movie, Black Klansman, which I really look forward to talking about. I don't think that Blindspotting is going to be the greatest of the African American films that we're seeing in this current wave. What I really hope is that this current wave continues on and on and on, and that we see a whole lot of movies exposing more and more of the tremendous, astonishing, and so long overlooked African-American talent in American film. And Blindspotting is a really, really worthwhile movie that has funny things to say and serious things to say. It ain't no masterpiece, but it's a really, really interesting movie. And so that is my pretty darn assorted and various story this week, Joe.